Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Darlitz.
Hello and welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. My name is Matthew Darlitz, Editor-in-Chief of the Science of Psychotherapy. And as always, I'm here with Richard Hill, our Managing Editor. Howdy, Richard.
Howdy, Matt. I'm talking to you from a hotel somewhere in north of New South Wales. It just shows you can do this stuff everywhere, but it's beautiful to see it.
It does sound like you're in a tiny little box, but
it feels a bit like that.
We'll forgive you for that. Now, Richard, cross to California.
Yes, and one of our best mates, Louis Cozzolino. He's brought out another book. Norton's are re-releasing one of his old books. We've got an excerpt in the magazine, and we want to talk to him about stuff. So just a brief reminder for those who possibly don't know Lou Cozzolino.
Okay. Dr. Louis Cozzolino practices psychotherapy and consulting psychology in Beverly Hills, California. And he lectures, he's written a stack of books. My bookshelf is full of his books. And he's been a professor at Pepperdine University since 1986, and he lectures around the world on psychotherapy, neuroscience, trauma, and attachment.
And he's going to talk to us about his new book, The Developing Psychotherapist. And what do we do? Let's jump over to California.
All right, let's go. Louis Cozzolino, welcome once again to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. So great to see you.
Same here. Good to be back with you.
Good to see you, Lou. Haven't seen you for a while. You're looking very splendiferous. That's wonderful.
I'm better preserved when I never leave the house.
Yes. We do all feel like pickles at the moment. It's quite interesting.
So, Lou, today we would love to have a chat with you about the development of therapists, the education and development of therapists, something that you've been intimately involved in for many, many years. And being the excellent educator that you are, you've put pen to paper and you've written a number of books to help young therapists enter this world of psychotherapy. And we've got a few new entries in the Norton series, The Development of a Therapist, Healing Others, Healing Self, and The Making of a Therapist, so a book that you've previously written, A Practical Guide for the Inner Journey. Can you tell us a little bit about these new entries in the Norton series?
Yeah, well, there's only one new entry, actually. The development of the making of a therapist came out in, I think, 2004.
Yep.
And with for years, I've been thinking about, writing. There were all of these bits and bobs that I didn't include in that in the making of a therapist because I thought they went a little too far for what I wanted to write. That book was really sort of a survival guide, like you put it in your pocket when you go into the jungle. And if you need to figure out how to start a fire without matches, I mean, that book was sort of like. So there's nothing changed in that book, but I think it must have been some sort of a marketing ploy to repackage it and to put it out with the new book, hoping that, hoping that it gives it some momentum. But I'm happy to say that The Making of a Therapist, of all the books I've written, is the one that continues to continues to be adopted to education programs, and it seems just about every week I get an email or I run into someone now online who said that they used that book in their program and they found it really helpful. So of all the work that I've done, I think that may be like the smile of the Cheshire Cat. That might be the one that remains after all of the other books go out of print and go into the used bins, at the rubbish stores. Like I said before, there were lots of bits and bobs and things that I wanted to expand upon. So the development of the therapist is sort of the next step. In other words, I took some of the principles and move them forward and expanded them, So if hopefully that book will have, as a similar impact to the prior one, and they'll be adopted maybe for the second year of a training program.
I think they make, great companions, and I think, The Making of a Therapist is the perfect precursor to the development of a therapist.
I think so too, because it was a good, I mean, I think it's a terrific book, Making a Therapist. And I mean, there's two good things about it. One, that it's just beautifully written and insightfully derived. And I'm not sure about the second one, is the fact that it's still so relevant, but it means the training programs we've got are still very, still bring people to the jungle without the fire lit yet. So, you know, they do need this. But then this beautiful thing of the developing therapist, okay, you know, once you've got in the jungle and you lit your fire, that's not it, boys, girls. Mm-hmm. There's something more. So this idea of the developing, and it's not just development, it's developing this, present continuous. I mean, how much does a therapist need to develop? Could you just expand a little bit on this framework of developing?
Well, I think probably the background for this is that therapy has become less and less, I'm not exactly sure the right words are, but it's become less and less professional and more paraprofessional and also more technique-based as opposed to knowledge-based. And so how students are being taught now is not really a broad foundation of the field and a broad notion of the human brain and mind and the various ways you can, you know, the various paths to Rome that you can take in order to get there and to help people. I guess maybe it's just the publishing business, the seminar business. All of these things seem to be based on particular technique, on techniques. Mm. And so what the students find themselves in the dilemma of running from pillar to post, trying to gather, it's sort of like an egg hunt. They're gathering all of these certifications and all of these books and all of these manuals, trying to figure out how to learn everything so that they can be a therapist. But there's really no definition about what it means to be a therapist, right? It's all about just learn everything you can and learn every technique possible. And I even see this in the doctoral programs and in the master's programs that you would think would have a deeper sense of understanding of the field, but they really don't. So in my biased view is that the training has devolved to the point where students get out into practice and they don't know how to swim. And so they grab onto whatever weekend workshop serves as a life preserver, and they just do that to everybody. Okay, I did an EMDR training, or I did, you name it. I mean, it's like there's the alphabet soup of a million different training programs. But when I have students or I have people who are in practice approach me for supervision, it becomes clear that they don't have any guiding principles of what therapy is or how to do it, right? And also they know this or that technique, but it's almost like only having two or three stones in a vast mosaic. They always feel lost and disoriented. And so I think, you know, the purpose of the books that I'm writing, and I'm working on a book now that it isn't even clear that, anyone wants to publish it, but it really is about, it's not about the technique of doing trauma therapy. It's about understanding trauma. Like deeply understanding it and understanding the biology of it, the psychology of it, the neuroanatomy of it, and then looking at all the different ways you can treat it, and then, you know, based on that foundation, making a treatment decision based on a conceptualization. But that's very old-fashioned, and I'm not sure enough people are interested in that going forward to where that's going to be the model of psychotherapy.
Wow, you say that's old-fashioned. I mean, I would have thought that is the way of the future. And so it's very sobering what you're saying, because I was hoping that you would say that, yeah, education is now going down this path of you know, now educating our people in deep knowledge of the system, so that then they can swim, like you say.
Yeah.
But
well, it could be. Again, I'm sitting in Los Angeles and I'm sitting in the United States. So I'm looking at the world from this perspective.
Right.
I would love to be wrong about this. And so if you're having a different perspective from where you are, that's wonderful. And then I'll just publish in Australia, New Zealand.
From yeah. I think, Matt, it's the conundrum. Perhaps because we often use the musical, a musician metaphors because it kind of fits because we're interested in that. But there's like, in order to improvise as a jazz player, you need to learn the scales. Mm-hmm. But when you improvise, you don't just play the scales. So it's this conundrum of how to learn the techniques and learn all the things, but not learn them so you can simply reproduce them, but so that something else emerges.
Is absolutely.
That the sort of thing we're talking about there?
Yeah, we can. Yeah, I mean, I think that, and jazz is a good analogy because jazz, from my perception, was always about taking advantage of the mistakes on one hand. You make a mistake and then that becomes a window to a new form or a new way of playing. And then if you've got an ensemble, if you have a quartet or trio, whatever it is, the real quality jazz musicians wanted to play with each other because they were so deeply attuned to one another that they could pick up on each other's mistake. It was like improv. It isn't like, but you did it wrong. It was like, ooh, let's go there.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. That type of thing. And I think that that's a really excellent model too for psychotherapy, because I guess I see, and think about what I try to write about in the development of a therapist is really, it's about the deep experience of the therapist. It's about understanding how social brains work, how executive functioning work, how what we've inherited from our primate past influences the way our brains and our bodies function. And so therapy to me is this sort of like deep connection that therapists and clients do together in that process. And that's, at least from what I see on my side of the water, is that that's not what people are getting taught to do. They're getting taught how to do programmatic interventions, acceptance and commitment therapy. And it's like, okay, well, acceptance, it means accepting your problems and committing to change them. So this, as far as I can tell, this is just a different way to sell books. It's not anything new. But the problem is that it confuses students because now there's another therapy with another set of letters that they have to learn. If they had learned fundamental, psychodynamic and humanistic and cognitive behavioral, therapies, they would look at all of these things floating by like Siddhartha did and watching the river go by and say, oh, there's another one, there's another one, there's another one. But instead they're insecure and confused and they're looking for the right script as opposed to the right, the proper experience and stance.
This is client responsive stuff that I'm, Bernie Rossi and Milton Erickson, I suppose, going back as looking at, because what surprises me is that so many therapeutic approaches that we talk about as brand new and exciting and this is the big breakthrough, as an old actor, I can find in Shakespeare, in the sense that Shakespeare wasn't doing it as a therapeutic thing. He was just writing about the human condition and the natural way. So this idea that the therapies that people have expanded, it's a bit more like science where you differentiate and expand the elements, but then they still have to come back together into the system. And I think one of the things that really is interesting, and I don't know whether it's surprising, it's not surprising to Matt and I because it's the way we think, but this idea that one of the ways in which you can improve the way you integrate and improvise and all these words we're talking about is actually kind of working on the self, working on you as a person.
Well, I think, and I guess, I was trained primarily in the 70s and 80s. So I'm a real dinosaur when it comes. If you look, like every once in a while, I'll go on my LinkedIn page and I'll look at pictures of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of psychologists, and they're all in their 20s and 30s. And so they've had a very different training experience, I would imagine, than I did. I know that when I was training, the thought of doing therapy without being in therapy and having a significant amount of therapeutic experience was just seemed silly or stupid. But now, and again, I'm speaking from where I sit in the world, but the schools don't demand that students do psychotherapy because they want all their tuition money going to the school. The students essentially don't have any money left, you know, after they, in fact, they're in debts hundreds of thousands of dollars when they graduate. So in many ways, we're almost assuring that a majority of the therapists we're training will not have any therapy experience themselves, right? So they're not going to have the experience of self-exploration in that context. They're not going to realize how frightening it is to go into therapy because they've never gone to therapy. They're not going to understand the struggles with defenses and all of those things. So they'll lack that basic empathy for the experience of the people they're doing therapy to, right? Let alone all of the internal psychological issues that you should be coming to understand and clear up in a sense, or at least have a handle on, so that they don't get too, you know, they don't muck up your work with your clients, you know, or I should say minimize the muck.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I heard early on that there's a lot of people that go into, you know, psychotherapy, counseling, because they're trying to work out their own problems. And I thought, oh, that's just a cliche. Surely that's not correct. But when you start supervising, and, you know, Richard and I have both been, you know, have done supervision, you find out, wow, there are a lot of therapists out there that are trying to work out their own issues. Yeah. In the midst of, you know, trying to be a practitioner. And that's something in your undergraduate and postgraduate work, you know, you should work out a lot of those things, I would imagine.
Right. But it's certainly not the case. And I think probably like 10 years ago or so, I realized that if I was going to continue teaching, I had to change a fundamental idea, which relates to what you're talking about, is I used to see clients as a group of people who I was dealing with in a certain way, and students, a group of people I was dealing with in another way.
Right.
Right. And I realized that if I was going to continue teaching where I'm teaching, I had to be able to conceptualize all of my students as clients. Because for the most part, they were non-treated therapy or trauma victims.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. So I really converted my classes into therapeutic workshops. But before that, it was a nightmare for me because I was expecting them to be able to do things like take feedback that they're not capable of doing because they didn't have the ego strength or the perspective to figure out how to take that that feedback without collapsing or crumbling under it.
Yes, this pressure to be successful. I mean, there's a number of people talking about this now, the nature of effective therapy, what makes it effective. Scott Miller's doing a lot of work in that. And in the looking through the literature and looking through a lot of the discussions of the different types of therapies, discovering that individually and in an isolated fashion, something like CBT isn't actually necessarily all that successful. And in fact, what we're seeing now is CBT plus this plus that. And they're saying, oh, that's much better. And it's what I describe as the tail is now wagging the dog. You know, back in the days as an actor, when you were on stage, you weren't just acting with the actors. You were also acting with the audience. And that was the place where we learned that everybody had a place and an influence in the experience. And so that's something the students aren't necessarily experiencing.
Yeah, maybe it comes back to the fact that, you know, we know that we are the instrument, we're the catalyst, we're the instrument of the therapeutic process. Maybe students are coming in from what Lou was saying, thinking, well, no, it's just an application of technique. We just have to be the appliers of technique. It's not actually our persona that is involved here, but it actually is.
Yeah. That's what we call the wooden actor.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think, too, you know, my perception is they see it almost... They see it as a relatively highly paid clerk position.
Right.
In other words, people come in, they've got a workbook, on whatever, you know, like depending on what the presenting complaint is, they grab a certain workbook and they go through those things and they give their clients homework. But it really is more like working at the, you know, the Department of Motor Vehicles or something. You're just you're processing, you know, yeah. Or like a waitress. Mm-hmm. Someone asks for a certain meal and you go get it and you bring it to the table. But there isn't really the sense of the symbiosis, the dyadic dance, the you know, the jazz improv, these sorts of things, right. Whatever metaphor you want to use. And you know, this is not that those techniques can help people, but as a, you know, in my own experience, that's the last thing I find interesting to do, you know, with my time. You know, certainly if I can tell someone something that might be helpful or give them a piece of advice, I would, but that's not psychotherapy from my perspective.
Right.
Well, another music metaphor, there's a lot of incredibly interesting and fabulously engaging songs that have been created from the same four chords. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the beauty of it. But I also find, to some degree, we're talking about students being jaded or view. But what I find is a lot of students saying, I'm doing this thing like I was taught, but it doesn't feel right.
Right.
So I think do you find that the students themselves are coming out or, you know, early practice and saying, I actually think I need to develop?
Oh, yeah, I get that. I mean, you know, the thing that I see most often that's the most worrisome is people go through some training program where they pay thousands of dollars to learn how to be, like, to do trauma-informed, which has no meaning, but, you know, trauma-informed CBT or this, that, or the other thing. And then they go into practice, and they're practicing for 6 months or a year, and then one of their clients commits suicide. And then they really have a crisis of faith, in a sense, or of confidence. You know, do I know what I'm doing? And when they contact me for supervision, you know, my response is, well, no, you don't know what you're doing because, you know, and it's not your fault. You've been sold. You know, you've got a little piece of paper that someone printed out that you can frame and put on your wall that says that you're a trauma therapist.
Mm.
Right. And of course, if you can print up these pieces of paper and sell them for thousands of dollars a piece, you know, someone's going to do it.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's like, yeah. It's in a sense what I'm doing with people now is like, I'm first of all, it's like building up their confidence. Trying to get them some, you know, help them gain perspective, working through the grief of having a client who commits suicide, say, and then thinking, well, now I think if you, in a sense, you've thought that being a therapist involves being a clerk, and now you have a sense that it's more than that, and are you willing to make the commitment to the type of work you need to do in order to really become, you know, a trauma therapist, say, or any kind of therapist? So really, I'm educating them about all the things that their training programs and their certificate programs don't do, because it's probably not in the best interest. It's not in the business plan of those other structures, you know. And so yeah. But it's a tragedy. I mean, it's a tragedy I don't know. It's like the United States did in the middle, Desert Storm. They sent people into combat and they didn't have enough, bulletproof vests for them. And they had to come up with their own money to buy their own equipment to protect right. themselves. You know, yeah. it's just, it's a travesty.
So, Lou, what do we have to do in terms of saving ourselves from the status quo, from these market forces? If you were to speak to other high level educators that are been in similar positions as yourself, what would your advice be to save us from this?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, we've got a, it's kind of like it's sort of like the medical system in the United States. It's fragmented. The things aren't in alignment, and none of it is in the best interest of the students. Right. Mm. And so I think, I don't know if we're capable of changing the system, but I think that there needs to almost be some sort of and I guess what this is what I'm trying to do, although I keep running into, you know, a resistance in it, which I understand why, But there needs to be an understanding of the value of broad training in the field and the necessity of psychotherapy for the psychotherapist, and bring back essentially all of the things that were the foundation of training a half a century ago or more. Those things, I mean, there were many things that weren't good, like whatever bizarre psychoanalytic theory someone had, and it was true just because I say so, you know, that stuff shouldn't come back. But what should come back is an attempt at some systematic education. And then, like, for example, EMDR. EMDR is a great technique. It works for some people some of the time, right? Yep. But being trained as an EMDR therapist doesn't mean you're a trauma therapist. It means you have a certificate that says you're a trauma therapist, right?
Yeah. Well,
so there needs to be almost like a figure ground shift. The figure can't be 10,000 different disparate trainings and techniques, right? The figure has to be broad training in psychotherapy and psychotherapy experience. And then part of that broad training is your teachers give you a box that has maybe 10 or 15 different compartments in it. And as you go through your training, you put different techniques in that box, but the box consists of your broad training and your understanding.
Yeah. Yeah. And I have to say, you know, we have to continually sort of move away from that old medical model as well, where, you know, I might be trained as an oncologist and I specialize in brain tumors. That fits very well in that medical model. But when it comes to psychotherapy, we're talking about a very different thing, about where we have to be very aware of a very broad system. Yeah.
Right. It was sort of my beef with you guys, you know, calling your website the neuropsychotherapist,
right?
Which created there were no letters in it, but it was part. It seemed to me, at least on the, you know, at a surface level, it was part of that problem. So I'm very happy. I'm very happy you changed.
Right.
well, it was a growth too. You know, when Matt started that, there was a certain influence that was, which really was someone who was trying to do exactly what you're saying we shouldn't do, is put fences around a particular thing and say that's the way to go. When I came on board, Matt just went, oh, yeah, this is a great idea. And, of course, I came on board having been influenced by people like yourself. I mean, I learned a lot about being a therapist from conversations, you know, sitting around having dinner with you, as much as I did from that, you know, that just learning that broader framework of being as a therapist. But I think this is where it gets scary. And I understand this to some extent from my acting career. Improvising, or simply allowing the best response at the moment to emerge without actually having some kind of cognitive control over it, is actually a tad scary. And I wonder if that's part of the problem too, is the getting to the space where you can actually have confidence in your self-organizing capacities as different from just these pragmatic reproductions of the technique.
I think that goes back, you know, that should be one of the key goals of the psychotherapy that you're going through, where you can get to the point where you can be the center of your experience and be centered in your experience, as opposed to be looking for meaning in the eyes of other people or in the brains of other people, right? I think that there's a radical vulnerability involved in therapy, just like there is in jazz. I mean, you're out there. You're not hiding behind anything, you know? And I think that's really what makes what unlocks, you know, I think we can have a whole nother discussion about what changes in the brain when we feel trusting to someone that opens up our mirror neurons and stimulates our neuroplastic capacities and allows us to, in a sense, be absorbed in a connection where we're truly resonating, and not just resonating, but also absorbing and imprinting on what our teacher or our therapist is giving us. I mean, think of the, you know, like the time I spent with Carl Rogers. After I got over my initial, starstruckness and and being pissed off at him for like not looking like he was doing anything. He didn't look like he was working very hard, which struck me the wrong way. But you know, once I got it, and once I trusted, and once I became vulnerable, I mean, those hours are still living inside of me. You know, yeah. I got Carl, like he's in here, and there's times when I need to go and get him. You know, if I lose track of him.
And you, that little bit there is in the excerpt that we've got in the magazine, because that's another reason why we're talking, is celebrating both the book coming out, but if you come into the current science of psychotherapy, you can read some of that. And I was fascinated, you know, reading, because I love it when I read people like you who were sort of, I went to a class with Carl Rogers. Oh, okay. But, you know, he looked like a disheveled teacher, and that sort of stuff is really fascinating. Go back to the old Carlos Castaneda days of going back, talking about the 60s and 70s, the art of doing nothing. In doing so, you have the capacity to do everything.
And that's a really, you know, just thinking about these therapists that I'm working with, they feel very pressured to be doing something. Mm-hmm. They can't sit quietly with a client. And that was one of the most, you know, important early lessons that I had, but no one's addressing that anymore. No one is addressing the centeredness, I use the word spiritual. I don't mean religious. I just mean there's that sense of creating sacred space by not filling it with shit or with agenda, right? So you sit down with someone, you're in this office, like, here, this is a space. I don't want to give you information. I want to figure out how to share wisdom. And so, you know, information becomes wisdom when it's interpreted through the eyes of compassion and understanding and really knowing someone, right? But you can't do anything like that if your mind is filled with checklists and obligations and trying to figure out what diagnosis someone has.
Because you talked about that ages ago, that it happens in the space between in the social neuroscience.
Yeah, and we've talked about this as well, because, you know, the science of psychotherapy is all about, you know, increasing our knowledge about a whole range of, you know, interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary, you know, things to do with this complex system of who we are. But it's not about taking all of that knowledge and then dumping it on the client as psychoeducation. It's about building a huge reservoir of knowledge that becomes then an intuition that, like you said, you can sit quietly with the client with, in an understanding that this is probably the most valuable thing the client is experiencing in their whole week.
Well, I think, too, like, you know, something that isn't appreciated, and I talk about it in a couple of different places in the development of therapists, is how neglected evolutionary theory is, and how important understanding evolution is to connect with you're talking about, Matt, is like that. That sort of embodied knowing and understanding that. So, like, you know, a key example for me is shame, right? Is that this core shame that we all experience, understanding that that's related to very, very primitive social organizations and hierarchies. And we spend so much time in therapy trying to figure out, well, who did it to you? Where did this core shame come from? And just as often, no one did it to you. It's just an inheritance of the fact that you're a primate. And so then the question isn't figuring out who did it. The question is figuring out, how do you live with it? It's like, you know, it's not going to go away, because it's hardwired. It's encoded in our genes and our biochemistry. So then the question is, let's shift from trying to figure out who did it to us to figure out how, like, almost like diabetes. How do we live? How do we optimize our living that we have this handicap? Right, and how do we domesticate the handicap?
Yeah, what is it telling us that we need to pay attention to? The way to go, if you wake up with a broken leg, it's a really good idea to perhaps not walk on it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we spend a time saying, well, you know, who broke the leg? And you go, maybe we should you know, allow the body to heal, and this natural capacity of the body. I sometimes do start, I'm talking now more about, we have a natural biological immune system, but we also have a natural mental health immune system that given the opportunity and the circumstances, it will move itself to it. You know, we like being happy. We much prefer it.
There are two different views of that, Richard, and it's a situation I think where both of them are true for different people in different situations. I think if you think about Maslow and the positive psychologists and the actualization folks, the thought, and I think Carl Rogers felt this way as well, it's like if you clear away shit, right, people will sort of develop and grow and actualize themselves. And then I think if you look at people like Wilhelm Reich and other analytic theorists, and I think if you look at the neurobiology and the evolution, there are also ways in which we tend to remain sick because of the way our brains process information and habit patterns that won't get better by acceptance, right? So yeah. I think as a therapist, we really have to figure out who's caught in a loop. So that you're actually going to have to make an incision into that loop. You have to like lance that in order to get in and do, you know, interpreting and all of that stuff and get involved in a deeper way. And who has enough, you know, ego strength, who has enough secure attachment, who has enough cognitive capacity where, in fact, if you do use Carl's perspective, you know, and you are there and you're compassionate and you're open, that they're going to heal in the context of relationship. Some people do, some people don't. And the one size fits all thing really is just not, it's just not viable and doesn't make any sense given, given human being.
So, and that's the thing, if you take that idea and combine the two, that the body will take itself, the person will take itself to the best place that they can get. And if you've got one leg shorter than the other, then you've got one leg shorter than the other. There's no amount of you know shit clearing that's going to make that leg grow. And it's going back to that basis of, again, what I talk about, I learned in acting school, that you are the being that you are. What do you do with it? How can we? And a play is usually this person taking themselves into some better place. And as you say, some characters don't make it. Mm-hmm. It's really, you know, theater is a Shakespeare teaches us a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Well, look, I am just really encouraged by your writings. I do believe that we can move from the status quo into something much better for the education of psychotherapists. And the people that are under your tutelage have been extremely fortunate.
Including me.
And I would just encourage everyone that hasn't been touched by Dr. Louis Cozzolino, you should get out and have a look at these two new books, The Development of a Therapist, Healing Others, Healing Self, and The Making of a Therapist, A Practical Guide for the Inner Journey.
Yeah, and if you've got a decade to spare, buy all of them. Just sit down and start reading because it's a treasure trove.
Yes, my bookshelf is full of Lou's works. So before we leave, Lou, is there any final words that you would like to leave our listeners with?
No, just, you know, I appreciate everyone's attention and certainly just, I would say, think on these things, you know, think about your training. And I'm hoping, like I said, I'm hoping that my views are idiosyncratic and come from a particular spot on the globe. And I hope they're not consistent with things everywhere. But to whatever degree you're confusing learning to be a therapist with learning a technique or confusing doing therapy to someone as opposed to learning how to do it with them, I would just ask you to, reconsider, give it some thought.
Right. Beautiful.
Beautiful. Indeed.
Dr. Louis Cozzolino, thank you so much for being here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast.
Thank you.
Well, there's never a dull moment when we're talking with Lou Cozzolino. Fascinating discussions again.
Yeah.
As we've seen in some other John Arden, we've got in his last word just saying we've got to do something about the way we do psychotherapy. And here's Lou saying really good stuff.
Yeah, so there's a few, you know, very wise voices saying that we do need to change the status quo here. Now, we're trying to do that here at the Science of Psychotherapy, give you a broad base of knowledge about this complex system called the human being. So if you are interested in seeing what we're all about, please jump across to thescienceofpsychotherapy.net. Check us out. We've got a standard subscription there, which gives you access to just about everything, or you could just subscribe to our magazine, our monthly magazine, The Science of Psychotherapy, and we feature experts from around the world every month.
Indeed, and we've got an excerpt from Lou's book this month, new things coming up. Anyway, fabulous new things coming up, which is terrific. I won't expand because everyone go and look at it, see.
All right, wonderful. Well, Richard, you continue to enjoy your holiday.
Yes, well, I am going to jump in the car in a minute and take a bit of a drive back towards home. So,
Okay. But
that'll be nice. We'll take it easy and look at the sights on the way.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you, everybody, for joining us here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast, and we will catch you next time.
Bye for now.
Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.